Hare Krishna. Thank you for coming. Actually, I was afraid more people would be here, so I'm kind of an introvert, so short introduction. I think around May of last year, when I was traveling, Ramaswamy email asking me if I could do a summary of this particular book, Reason and Belief, Problem Solving in the Philosophy of Religion. It's a book written by my spiritual master, His Holiness Tamal Krishna Goswami. So at that time I was traveling, I didn't have the book. I said, okay Maharaj, you know, we'll do a service for you, I'll do the summary. And he was happy, and then he said, when can you do it? I said, I'm traveling, I don't have the book, but maybe sometime in October, if I get in touch, I'll start. And he said, okay. So then I got the book, and then as I was reading, actually I helped my spiritual master with the production of the book, so during that time I would read a little bit here, and then I'll say, this is too much. This book was written as in his SMU, Southern Methodist University days. He was doing his degree. In 1995, he decided that he was traveling quite often preaching, so some of his god brothers encouraged him to go into the university to preach with the academics. So then he took that challenge up. So when he undertook this course in the philosophy, the professor, Dr. Lonnie Cleaver, was very impressed. So he encouraged him to actually compile and publish the essays he did for his assignments. So basically this is what it is. And for information, my spiritual master, not because he's my spiritual master, I'm saying he's no ordinary person. He was a 4.0 student. And among all the students, in the Department of Philosophy, he was elected as the top student. And among the different departments, he was elected one of the two top students. So devotees of Hare Krishna are no ordinary people. So that's my understanding. So whilst I was traveling, in October I started reading, and I said, my God, I don't even understand it. So, because it's written in the language of the, it's English, but it's written in their language. The philosophers, the academics, they write it so that you don't understand what they're saying. It's true. So if you do, then you question them. So they come up with this methodology where all PhDs must learn to write so that no one understands. It's like munis, Each muni will come up with his own way of explaining things. So this is what I realized. It wasn't easy. So it took me from October till December reading this many times just to come up with the summary. There's 10 chapters in here, and it's about 150, 160. And I remember one day I was walking with my Guru Maharaj during his Vyasa Puja. He had published it, and then he was selling it to the disciples. And so, yeah. So then he said, oh, the book, I'll give you all for a cheap rate, $10. But if you want my signature, you'll have to give $20. So anyway, it was fun at that time. So whilst we were walking back to his ashram, he was saying, this book is not for you guys. But it's very well written. There's a lot of interesting concepts there. Basically it's a comparison of the philosophies that the Western theologians and so on speak, and Prabhupada says. That's what I'm also trying to do here, okay? So, All right, I guess we can start now, right? So the first chapter is called The Nature of Religious Experience. You can also say Encounters with the Supreme or the Divine. Okay? Let me run. See, technology, I'm not so used to PowerPoint, but Satyasar Prabhu helped me out with this. So if there's anything missing or you know who to call. Anyway, I did some modification, so I should be blamed also. So in any case, okay, let's see if it runs. And then we don't have a cable long enough to control, so I have to telepathically control Prabhu there. So actually, you're supposed to do it one at a time, but it doesn't matter. So religious experience is, for some people, it's like when you say what a religious experience is, for them, it's like, if I come to a temple, that's a religious experience. Going to a church is a religious experience. Seeing someone, gospels singing, that's also a religious experience. So it depends on the level of a person's intention to get immersed with the situation of that religious gatherings and so on. Now, in terms of the philosophy here, religious experience is mainly something that you actually encounter with the Supreme, with the Divine. It's an experience that you feel. Each and every one of us may have a different experience. So this is where the philosophers want to quantify it. And therefore they want to have a common ground. And hence this essay, What is Religious Experience? So we find that there's personalities like in the theologian in the Western society, a very important person, Richard Swinburne. He's probably their Mahatmas or like that. And they have a certain way of defining religious experience and so on. So he particularly came out with five categories. And it's either public or private, the experience. Public experience means others can see it at the same time. Private experience is your personal experience. So let me just read five of this that he has outlined. He considers public a believer who sees God's hand at work, whereas other explanations are cited. Example, if you look at the sunset, everyone says, oh, that's a beautiful sunset. So everyone agrees that God has done a wonderful thing. So that's their experience to one level. And then another public experience is an unusual event that breaches the natural law. That means a group of people seeing another individual, for example, walking on water. So everybody sees the person walk on water, right? Like that. Or see the ocean path, up like Red Sea for Moses, like that. So that's a public experience. And then the private experience is you see some vision, and then you describe it in your own way, what you saw. So that is considered a private. It can be described, but it is still a private experience. And then there's another private experience, which is indescribable. That means you cannot describe it. But they feel something mystical. Oh, I saw this flash, or something shimmering, gold or something, and then I felt this way. So that's another private experience. Or in the last category, they consider private experiences that in your life you do certain things and you find there's always some divinity in your life that's guiding you, that is making certain things come true. So that is considered a private experience also. But then the problem lies is that as I said, they can't quantify what is your experience and what is your experience. There's individuals and they all feel differently. So therefore, critics always, which is very common in the Western theology, they like to pick whatever someone says, pick and, you know, and say why this way, why not another way, and like that. So therefore, he came up with another two principles for the assessment of religious experiences. So those two principles are known as the principle of credulity, which explains that the absence of any reason to disbelieve it. That means someone experiences it and you hear and then you can say, well, that's possible. So that's the absence of any reason to disbelieve it. One should accept what appears to be true. Example, again, if one sees someone walking on water, one should believe that it is happening, right? If everybody sees and looks at each other and say, no, we didn't see that. That's not what he means by that, okay? And then the second principle is, he calls it the principle of testimony. With the absence of any reason to disbelieve them, one should accept witnesses are telling the truth. So that means we give the benefit of doubt. Everybody is saying that, so we'll accept that. Not that everybody agreed to come and lie like that. No, it's a different situation. Everybody agrees in that way. Of course, then the question is, are these experiences, do they fall in these categories? Are they just emotional experience? Someone can be very emotional. So is it an emotional experience or is it a perceptual experience? Is it because of my perception of it? Or is it, the final category is the supernatural. Something you can't explain, like supernatural. So that's what they are saying. So then we have the next personalities. They come with different views on religious experience. So they, each philosopher, as I said earlier, they're like Munis, they come up with their own understanding. It could be the same thing, a perception, but still they will say, I perceive it in this way, you perceive it in another way, like that. So they all have their own different views. So there's another person, his name is Friedrich Schleiermacher. These are all famous people in the Western theology. For most of us, we've never heard of these people. We only know Haridas Thakur, Raghunath Das Babaji, right? So in one sense, we are narrow-minded. In one sense. But actually, you know, we don't need to be, I shouldn't say broad-minded. Broad-mindedness means Mahatma. So we should know to what extent they understand the philosophies also. So that's what I'm trying to say. So yeah. So the father, he's the father of modern theology. It's stated there. He contends that faith is a self-authenticating, which means you feel that within your experience. You feel the Lord is helping me out in this way. So it's a self-authenticating. But still, people argue, right? If it's a self-authenticating, how do I know what you are feeling is exactly what I'm feeling, right? For example, you go to the cooks, you can ask the cooks, you know, the food you cooked today, the prasadam was very bland. Then the cook would say, I put in a couple of spices. Your experience is different. For the cook, that couple of spices is more than what you want. So it's like that, even among the Western theologians. So this kind of authentication is considered to be intuitive rather than cognitive. Okay? That means you feel it rather than you see it. Okay? And then there's another personality. All great personalities. Rudolf Otto. These are German personalities. Now he agrees that God's nature is deep. All right, he agrees. And so he says, since the Lord is so deep, you cannot really understand him by reason. Okay? But you can understand him through your feelings and emotions. So that's his understanding. Rudolf Otto feels like that. But then, if someone is feeling something, as I said earlier, and that's their emotions, how can you unlock and know exactly how they are feeling this way? Why are they feeling that way? Part of the philosophers in the Western society is they want to actually bring everything as an objective measure rather than an individual or subjective. Because again, when it's subjective, it's the tendency is to sometimes add extra spices. You tend to make up stories and so on. So that is a flaw there, and therefore they argue that emotions and so on are not a good way of understanding God. So if God is too great or extreme to be expressed or described in words, and the experience of him a non-cognitive act, how can beliefs and practices ever be formulated? So you cannot formulate some kind of system. They say we can't have a methodology if everyone is going to be emotional, right? And even if they are going to formulate some kind of methodology to worship, they ask the question how we can be sure that it is completely devoid of emotions, right? Sometimes we push something because we are emotionally attached to it, right? If you like something, then you will fight for it. Right? It may not be good for you, but you'll fight for it because you like it. So therefore, Rudolf Otto's argument is in question and it raises doubts. So therefore, they kind of discard his argument. So then we continue with another one. William Alston, yeah, as I said, there's many acharyas also. So, just like we have so many acharyas, so they also have acharyas. So, here is identifying the religious experience as a type of perception, how you perceive things. But then they argue again. They always argue, right? They say, the argument is, if you're saying you're going to perceive this, then there's a problem with this, because religious experiences are always non-sensory. It's not something that you use your senses to perceive. So therefore they say this doesn't work. And so they say it's a mistake to regard religious experiences as forms of perception similar to the perception of ordinary things. It becomes difficult for them. Because on the one hand, they say religious experience, which is spiritual, how can it be equal to something that you see and do with a material thing? So therefore, they say that's not a good analysis. And the problem is, Most religious experience or in cases where people say they had visions of God and so on, it generally is very vague. They can't really give a good description of what they actually experience. This, like I said earlier on, it could be described, but it is not really perceived properly. I saw this flash of light and I heard a voice. Like that. So it's not really perceived clearly. So therefore they say it's difficult to really understand this. And so if someone says, I heard, I'm hearing these voices telling me to do this and that, it could be two things. Either the super soul is talking or you're damn crazy, you know, right? So therefore they have a difficult time to do a comparative analysis of experiences like that. Then the supernatural arguments who Wayne Proudfoot, pretty proud, He has his own explanation on supernatural or belief that it fails. Even though they like that things like supernatural, you cannot understand this because it's supernatural. Okay, but then it again fails, as each religious person will prefer to understand. That means different community of religious people, whether it's Hindu or Muslims or Catholics, they all will come to understand in terms of their own belief system. Whatever system they follow, they'll say, well, this is the way it should be understood. Right? Oftentimes when you are preaching or giving books out, people will argue, and then you'll see they have their own set of understanding. Unless we really understand our philosophy better, we can't explain it in the level that they can perceive what you're saying. So it becomes a challenge. And again, therefore, they say there's no objective understanding can be made. So then you have this other, so many others who argue that perfection or pure consciousness is a state that transcends all categories and experiences. So this another group will say, no, you cannot quantify, you cannot say all these things, because that's not how it is. So then we look at the Vedic view, okay? And amazingly, you find that Srila Prabhupada gives an entirely different story of how one perceives religious experience. He actually kind of quantifies it. So if you look in Canto 1, Chapter 6, verses 15 to 19, Srila Prabhupada, I'll read the translations and we can understand something nice from this. Narada is describing his religious experience to Vyasadeva, right? After that of a banyan tree in an uninhabited forest, I began to meditate upon the super soul situated within, using my intelligence, as I had learned from the liberated souls. So he got the mercy from the Mahatmas who came and visited him. As soon as I began to meditate upon the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead, with my mind transformed in transcendental love, tears rolled down my eyes, and without delay, the personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, appeared on the lotus of my heart. O Vyasadeva, at that time, been exceedingly overpowered by feelings of happiness, every part of my body became separately enlivened. Been absorbed in an ocean of ecstasy, I could not see both myself and the Lord. The transcendental form of the Lord, as it is, satisfies the mind's desire and at once erases all mental incongruities. Upon losing that form, I suddenly got up, being perturbed, as is usual when one loses that which is desirable. I desired to see again that transcendental form of the Lord, but despite my attempts to concentrate upon the heart with eagerness to view the form again, I could not see him anymore, and thus dissatisfied, I was very much aggrieved. So what you see here is that all the categories that were previously discarded in the previous argument is again declared here by Narada. He's saying things like striking feature, ideas, external input, all these things you don't have to discard anymore. Because according to the Western theology, certain things they don't want to accept. They say, well, this is emotional, this is sensory, so we cannot accept here. But here you see, Narada is emotional, he's filling in, his senses are enlivened, and all this are being displayed. So therefore, you can say, remember the five categories I was talking about in the beginning by Swinburne, the Mahatma. So the fifth category is private. It's non-specific, general feeling of God working on one's life. So So therefore, it's a fifth possibility that experiencing God without any mediating object. It's a direct experience he is feeling. So, this is both phenomenal, that means he is experiencing it through his senses, exactly. But there's a difference, you know, not that his senses are mundane. His senses have been purified, actually, which is not addressed by the Western theologians. And it is objective. That means, as you can see, it is not influenced by his personal feelings or his own opinion. Now, how do we know that? It is based on his religious experience and is coming from his disciplic succession. The methodology he employs is through the Guru Parampara system, where he learned it from the saints who visited him, and they told him how to perform this meditation. And therefore, it is experienced, and it can be again experimented again. Right? Now, the funny thing is here, we notice that when Narada tries again, it doesn't work. So therefore, one would say, nah, this method doesn't work, you know. Prabhupada text 19, that's very nice, and I'll read it to you. Prabhupada says, there is no mechanical process to see the form of the Lord. No mechanical process. This is the key sentence. It completely depends on the causeless mercy of the Lord. Okay. That means you can follow everything perfectly as a devotee, but it is not a guarantee. It's up to Krishna to give you his mercy, pure love. So same way Prabhupada says, it completely depends on the causeless mercy of the Lord. So sometimes devotees are, you know, chanting for many years and so on. They said, I've been doing it so long. Why? Why am I not experiencing it? You know? But the amazing thing is, you're doing it for so many years. Right? You're not experiencing it, it's because Krishna is testing you still. Yeah? We tend to think that, just like you go to college, what, 4 years nowadays? Yeah, 4 years. I was lucky I had to do 3 years. So, 4 years and then you're assured of a degree. Yeah. So similarly, after going through all this cycle of studies and so on, you're guaranteed, they will tell you, you're guaranteed this. Everything is guaranteed, but when you come to Krishna consciousness, no guarantee. Actually, Prabhupada says it's guaranteed, right? But it's a question of time and your qualification. You'll get it, but it's up to Krishna, right? You'll get it, but it's up to Krishna. So it could be one lifetime, could be a million lifetimes. There is a particular pastime, right? When the, who's that? Chandrasekhar Acharya? No, who's that? Oh yeah, that's right, Mukunda. He goes and listens to the Mayavadis and then the Mahaprabhu, I don't look at him. So they say, when can I look? He said, oh, in 100 lifetimes later. Then 1,000 lifetimes. Then when he heard that, he was so happy and excited, he started jumping. I will get to see the Lord after 1,000 lifetimes. So he got some indication when he will see it. But actually the Lord was playing a fool with him. So in the same way, if you follow the process according to the way Prabhupada has set up, you are guaranteed to going back to Godhead. Because Prabhupada assures that. But it's up to Krishna to say, okay, time to get on the train. Alright? Or you take the train, slow train to China, you know, like they say. So it's like that. So here we see Prabhupada continues. And this is a very good purport. If you go back, you should read it. Canto 1, chapter 6, verse 19 purport. We cannot demand the Lord to be present before our vision, just as we cannot demand the sun to rise whenever we like. Right? Up, down. It happens in Goloka, but not here. The sun rises out of his own accord, so also the Lord is pleased to be present out of his causeless mercy. One should simply await the opportune moment and go on discharging his prescribed duty in devotional service of the Lord. I like that. Simply await the opportune moment and go on discharging. That means what? We should believe that we will go back to Godhead and not worry about it anymore. Just continue with your service. Exactly. Right? So no need to think about it from now on. Just do your service. Narada Muni thought that the Lord could be seen again by the same mechanical process which was successful in the first attempt. But in spite of his utmost endeavor, he could not make the second attempt successful. The Lord is completely independent of all obligations. He can simply be bound up by the tie of unalloyed devotion. Nor is he visible or perceivable by our material senses. When he pleases, being satisfied with the sincere attempt of devotional service, depending completely on the mercy of the Lord, then he may be seen out of his own accord. So one thing is for sure, right? We cannot outrightly say that people don't have religious experience. Rather, to actually experience religious experiences, we need someone to teach us. Yeah. And that is the role of a guru. Alright? The difference between ordinary theologians who don't have any methodology and the ones that Srila Prabhupada and the Guru Parampara teaches is that we are bound by this rules and the Vedic teachings where we cannot make up our own understanding. The teaching must be in line with these scriptures. So it's like Guru, Sadhu and Shastra, they all have to agree. We can't interpret and do what we want. So therefore the role of the guru is not free to teach what they are supposed to teach. So this role of guru doesn't just apply to the spiritual master alone, it applies to all of us. Because we are always teaching someone through our own example, okay. Yeah. When you say your own example, you're putting yourself as the... So it's not. Through your own behavior. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So we have to be very careful how we act. So you may speak one thing and then do another thing. So therefore we have to be very careful. Now the other thing is we draw from the depositorium of truth. For us, that is called the scriptures, Vedas, Srimad Bhagavatam, Srimad Bhagavad Gita, like that. And it allows the deepening of faith, which means by application with the spiritual master, our faith has to get stronger and more enlivening. Not that you say, you know, I have some problem with this, and then the person next to you say, yeah, this is a whole nonsense, don't do it. I'm giving you a crude example, but sometimes devotees talk among themselves, and if you are very astute and if you have sharp ears, you can hear some funny things going on. They will say or they make up things also. And so because the tendency is we like to all be the big guru. But we are not. Our role is actually to guide people, not that we control others. We are not meant to control. Guide them to who? Yeah, Krishna. Bring them to Krishna, that's all. Krishna can do whatever he likes with them, but you guide according to him of truth. And so we are meant to deepen another's faith. Even if they are from a different guru, you cannot say something that will diminish their faith in their guru. That is offenses. Okay, we should be very careful with that. And the guru always allows the disciple to grow in his understanding of the philosophy, in his understanding of application of that philosophy. And in that way, he will come to a better realization. So ultimately, whatever we see of Narada's experience, the scientists, they will argue that such experience may not be accurate. They will still argue, because that's how they are. When we are having a scientific bent in things in life, we always want a reason behind it. But as Prabhupada already said, Krishna, he does what he wants to do. Right? He has his own free will. And we cannot demand from Krishna, this is how I want. So they will say, look, we can prove it to you. Narada only experienced one time. The second time he didn't do it. But you know something? The scriptures are very good like that. You know why? It's to trap people who are faithless. So you'll find within the scriptures there are inconsistencies or contradictions. These contradictions are to, it's like holes in when you walk, there are big holes. Those who can see, they jump over. Those who can't see, they fall through. So scriptures are like that. They are placed in such a way that those who do not have sufficient faith, they will disbelieve it and they'll go away. It's for their own protection, actually. Okay? Gopitritva this morning. So Krishna actually also protects them. Okay? It's like that. So religious experiences, you cannot be reduced to any kind of experience, actually. It requires both supernatural explanation as well. We can't just simply give a material understanding of it. And finally, hearing such experiences are also very good, because it provides the faithful with the vision of God, and of equal importance, it illuminates their earthly path of morality and gives hope that they too may one day attain that vision. So that's the first chapter, religious experience. Hey, it took me a while to come to that, okay. All right, chapter 2 is theistic arguments. He goes faster than my intent. My telepathy is not good. Huh? Oh, it's refreshing. Okay. Now, there's according to a lot of these philosophers, the belief in supernatural power has always been there since the beginning of historical, since history, beginning of history. Or you can say ancient times. And much of it hasn't changed even now. The same kind of beliefs still prevail and go on and go on. But what has happened over the years is both science and technological improvements in our life has kind of taken over the role of religion to a greater extent. And therefore, as it's stated here, there's people tend to doubt. Because they say, well, you know, those days when you have certain kind of disease, they'll say, go and pray, right? I remember when we were young, when the children, they used to get chicken pox, right? Then they say, you have to go and pray to this demigod or pray to this Lord and things like that. And then that's about it. You just lay in bed and your parents do the prayers and then you recover. But then science comes along and say, hey, actually there's this virus actually. And then this bit of virus, it goes through incubation 15 days and then it comes out and then it lasts another 10 days and then everything goes quiet. And then when people look at that in that way, they say, yeah, science is right. And then of course, when we go to the Lord and we pray, please help us, you know, while we are suffering like that, and then nothing happens. And so then they say, well, I don't believe it anymore. And the peacock is saying, sham, sham, sham. But they say, no, I can't believe it. Does it say sham or ram? Huh? Oh, you can't hear sham or ram? Think about it next time the peacock makes the noise. Just try to hear very carefully. Does he say Sham or does he say Ram? So therefore there's a lot of doubts, and these doubts come across because of scientists. And the scientists and technologists nowadays, they are the brahmanas of the society. It's a fact. They are the brahmanas now. And then the politicians, the really low class politicians, They are the so-called kshatriyas. So they believe, or they use the scientists to propagate what they want. And it's a fact. You'll see that. They've ruined the world and they don't know what else to do. So they continue to ruin everyone. So therefore, when we analyze carefully, it appears that one's faith must be dependent on reason and logic. You see, it moves away from belief in a system to now more of logic, reason and logic. Now remember, if you apply reason and logic, it can only take you up to a certain level. And then they cannot answer anything else. Usually the scientists will say, we will find out. We will explain in 5 years. We will explain in 10 years. And Prabhupada calls that, yes, post-data check. If you're intelligent, you will say, you give me the money first, at least some portion of the money, and then we can take the other portion later. But the scientist will still say, I'll give you a post-data check. So then does it mean that the methods of science and philosophy are equally applicable in the study of religion? So one question is that. Does it mean both are applicable? It may be. Or some people will argue, is God's existence totally necessary for us to exist? Yeah. So that question also comes. So this is a question both the theist and the atheist argue. You know, like, what's that guy, the famous guy, Richard Dawkins? Dawkins, right? Yeah. Huh? Hawkins? No, Hawkins is the physicist. Dawkins is the atheist. Huh? They're pretty close. They're both atheists. But he's a physicist. Yeah. Is that time for the aarti? Oh, Jai Shri Shri Radha Damodar Ki Jai. Hare Krishna. This is my second time in Gita Nagari. The first time I came in 1990. 93, 22 years ago. At that time, the temple was downstairs. And then you walk across, it was always muddy. No, we came, when I came, it was all raining. It was in winter time. And then deities were now raised higher. They were much lower in those days. And then there were many more deities. And then they were very near. You can just stand and look at them. So it's a different experience now. It's like not in the same way, but it's like that. Like when Radharani goes to the Kurukshetra, she says, "I see you, but you are now like a king up there." So that kind of feeling is there because you see them so close before that. And I remember Mother Kamalini would get up at 2 in the morning. She'd go and milk the cows. And then she'd come at 4:30 and do the Mangala Arati every day. And it was like, my God, how can she do it? But you know, they are up there. It is. Actually, many of Prabhupada's disciples are very special. So, take a lot of association there and go. Alright? They are very special. Right, 80s and this. So then the proof of God is dependent on the prejudice of the people's prior conviction. Right? That's a fact usually. If you have something very strong in your heart, that's what you're going to follow, unless someone can come and disprove you. And oftentimes we see, even if you can disprove someone's belief, If they're not willing to accept it, they're not going to listen. So our whole idea is not that we are going to go and defeat somebody. Right? The whole Krishna consciousness, the movement is not meant to defeat and say we are the best. No. We are meant to show people there's another way of approaching the Lord. There's a way to love God also, like that. And the best way is how we behave. Right? Alright, so then there are acceptable proof is an argument that someone, not necessarily everyone, knows to be sound. So that's logic. So acceptable characteristics of proofs. A lot of time there's arguments based on valid premises. That gives rise to logical conclusions. That's one acceptable proof. And then the second proof is an argument that someone, not necessarily everyone, knows to be sound. Okay? And then the third kind of proof is proofs must extend knowledge. So this is how they argue. Now, we also understand that there is the design in nature, which is very common nowadays, right? A lot of the time people argue that this entire creation came out of some explosion, you know. Why it exploded, they can't tell you. Or they will say it's immense mass. Anyway, it's funny. So there's this person, another Acharya, William Paley. It's true because people follow them, you know. Now, when I was in college, I was doing group dynamics in one course, and then the things they were saying were so common sense. But then they had personality's name, he came with that rule. Then I was thinking, I thought about it when I was a little kid. What's this? Guys. It's a fact, right? Sometimes you know about it, then you see why this guy's name must be there. So anyway, William Paley, he came up with a very, which is used quite often in arguments by a lot of theologians. He uses the analogy of the simple watch. Says the parts of the watch did not come out of themselves. Somebody must have made that. And if people say it is by chance, right, you take the all the parts of a watch put in your handkerchief and then you shake it, it should all come together, right? By chance. So that's his argument. It doesn't work. Somebody has to assemble it. So therefore he says there's a superior intelligence. So he says there's a person like that. Now David Hume, I don't know, is it Hume or Hume? Huh? Hume. Hume, okay. Depends which country you're from. No? He argues against William Paley. So they become like monies, right? Moni means you argue and see who's better. Now he says, if analogy depends on points of similarity, then the watch and nature are worlds apart. Watch is not part of nature like that. Though reason may govern man-made creations, there are other principles at work in nature. So that's his argument. If the principles of causality are used to explain the existence of God, then God must also be subjected to the same principles. See how it's a circular argument, you know. So they say, so God also must be subjected to these rules. And therefore Krishna says, I therefore also follow these rules so that I will set examples. Yad yada charati shrestas, right? So he says that because of people like that. You know. But then the theists, they will argue. Okay? They argue that evolution can describe means and ordering to some extent, but it cannot actually explain it. They can give you some reason behind certain things, but they cannot fully explain it, which is true. When you study your biology or genetics and so on, they can't totally give you a good explanation. The scientific explanation is expected to follow a hypothetical deductive method, but the theory of natural selection is unable to predict specific outcomes from the theory and then test that they follow. All right, they cannot repeat it themselves also. The evolutionists counter that though biology is not as predictable as physics or other sciences, their role as an interpretive paradigm used as an analyzing tool is sufficient. So they will change their rules as and when they like it. You know, if it fits their thing, they will change it, you know. It's a fact actually, you know. You think they can really see the atom? So what is the electron microscope sees? So they see something and then based on their formulas and rules and laws of mass attraction and so on, they say this is the way this atom is, you know. Which you got to give them credit for that, you know. They're pretty good at that. They're actually smart, actually. In any case, natural science cannot explain certain aspects of the universe. It cannot explain why non-living elements should give rise to life rather than to non-living things. Right? It's a good argument. How the earth, planetary system, the chemical composition are so ideally suited to support life. Why organisms develop to greater complexity, since complexity is not always necessary for survival of the fittest. Right? They say evolution means become complicated. But actually you see in some life forms they are very simple. And they are still living. How sophisticated information processing occurs at microbiological level. Right? Like you take the Krebs cycle in the photosynthesis, right, those who have done biology and so on, yeah. So you see, it's so complicated. How is it that it's done in the cellular level? They can't answer that. Or they'll give you something that they will all agree on first. Now the Vaishnavas, they understand things differently. Because, our understanding is from the scriptures, Vedic scriptures. So the sources of truth for us is scripture. And we don't, the interesting part is vision. We do question it, but we don't challenge it in the sense. Once you question, you understand it, then it makes it easy. Sometimes, I do not know about many of you, but I remember when the first time I read the Bhagavad Gita, I was reading chapter 1, yeah, no problem. Chapter 2, okay, a little bit complicated. Chapter 3, Karma Yoga, I can still get, understand something. Chapter 4, too much. So then I put it on the shelf. And then I said, all right, let's do the Bhagavatam. So, because it had more stories in it. So I read Canto 1, okay, Canto 2. It was interesting because universe creation, a lot of technical jargon. So I said, all right, Canto 3, Kardama Muni and all his wonderful dealings with Devahuti and Kapila Dev, and then I said, fine, you know, Canto 4, Puranjana and all, it was too much for me, put it on the shelf. So then I saw Chaitanya Charitamrita. But interesting enough, I understood Chaitanya Charitamrita, and then I went back to Bhagavad Gita and I read it. Because of the loving relationship in Chaitanya Charitamrita, it made it easy for me to accept it. And Prabhupada, actually, he reveals so much in Chaitanya Charitamrita, if you all read it. And so it made my understanding of the Bhagavad Gita easier. So then I went back and read it. Alright, then Vaishnavas, they don't accept truths that are flawed by human defects. Right? What are the four defects? Tendency to make mistakes. Tendency to cheat. Imperfect senses. Subject to illusion. Thank you. Yeah. So therefore, we don't accept any human consideration. So we take our considerations from the Vedic scriptures, and we understand the scriptures are apurushaya. That's it. That means it is not man-made. It's coming from the Supreme Lord. So this is how we actually approach a topic within our circle of influence. Okay? We don't just say, okay, they say that, they say. Yeah, sometimes we listen. You always have to listen, because if you don't listen, then you are showing a sense of immaturity. Because sometimes a person may be suffering, and they may tell you their whole life story until they tell you exactly what the problem is. Have you encountered that? Have you all encountered that? No? I have done plenty of them. That's why if you become a devotee, you learn tolerance, patience. It's true. You just sit and listen, and then all they want to do is talk to you, and then they say thank you. Because you listened. And then Krishna and their heart reveals to them, Dadami Buddhi Yogam Tam. They say, thank you for helping out. And you are like, yeah, no problem. Same time next week. It is like that. And then Vaishnavas also consider direct perception or evidence. It's known as pratyaksha. Okay? What we see. And reasoning. Anu mana. And which are secondary to the Vedic assertions, which is Shabda. Shabda Pramana. The highest is Shabda Pramana. So first Shabda Pramana, then others, then subsequently we go each one. And of course, even tradition is also considered sometimes, you know, as a proof. Some people will follow certain tradition to do certain things. But because of the subject to errors, we do not consider pratyaksha and anuman are only used as a support to shabda. That's how we use that. Huh? Not directly, we don't say this is it. You know, we have to prove it with shabda principle. Okay, the highest principle is shabda. Then we go on to the existence of God. So there's a Christian definition. In the Christian theologian, he's a person known as Anselm. He proposes God as a being than which none greater can be conceived. That's how he's defining God. A being than which none greater can be conceived. But we have our parasaramuni, right? What is that? The six opulences, right? What is that verse called? Viryasya, yashasyascha. No, aishvaryasya, samagrasya, viryasya, yashasyascha, jnana vairagyascha, sannam bhagam itinganaha. Right? These are the six opulences of the Lord. And they are? What's happening? What is the first one? Okay. Aishwarya is? Wealth. Yashashyascha, fame. Strength or, okay, beauty, knowledge and renunciation. How do you remember renunciation? Chaitanya Mahaprabhu or Krishna? Always remember the rasa dance, right? He's able to get out of the rasa dance. Yeah, that's amazing renunciation. So according to Vishnu Purana, this is what Parasara Muni says, when these kinds of opulence are present in someone to a superlative degree, that person is Bhagavan or God. The word is superlative, because sometimes these opulences you can find in some individuals somewhat, but not necessarily. Now, the Vishnu, as long as they are expansions of Krishna, they are all full in these six opulences. Right? They may not exhibit completely, but they are full because they are Vishnu's avatars. Okay. And then there's another word known as Asamma Urdhva. Asamma Urdhva means that no one is found equal to him or greater than him. So these words are used to describe Krishna. And Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, 14th chapter, verse 4, it should be understood that all species of life, O son of Kunti, are made possible by birth in this material nature, and that I am the seed-giving father. The naturalists argue that the order of the universe is product of but a result of natural selection, the prime mechanism of evolution. Vaishnavas assert that God is the prime mover of the universe, and this is in Bhagavad Gita 9:10. Denial of an absolute authority brings with it denial of accountability to such authority and causes one to question whether any levels of authority, standards of conduct, or codes of morality need be recognized. Let me read that again. Denial of an absolute authority brings with it denial of accountability to such authority and causes one to question whether any levels of authority, standards of conduct, or codes of morality need be recognized. So generally, people who don't want God, they actually want this. That's what it is, you know, so that they can do whatever they can do. And more or less you find that's what's happening around the world. You know, if people believe in God, then they will fall into a certain paradigm. And they cannot be controlled. And so, therefore, the atheists cut them down. And now why do they do that? What is the reason behind that? Can anyone give a quick answer? Very close. It's all economy, you know? Basically. How to exploit and make money. Because that's their life goal, right? As long as they can make money or exploit another person, that's, and therefore, if anyone believes in God, they'll say, I don't need this. I don't need the, iPad. Or the, whatever they have nowadays, right? So then they'll say, no, you need it. You know, you gotta look at all the, what they look at? All the games, right? Yeah. Huh? Apps. What kind of apps you can play? Yeah. I was traveling in which country was it? It was Hong Kong. So I was in the mass rapid transportation system. So it's like their subway system. So I was in there, and then I got on the cab, and then I was looking, and everyone was. I thought they were all praying, but actually they were not praying. They were all playing. It's amazing. It's just amazing that the number of people nowadays, you know, like you go into a public transportation, you want to look at people, they don't even want to look at your eyes, they're like, you know, they all want to look at their iPhone or iThing or whatever. Right, isn't it? I have my iPhone also. But I've always got it on silent mode. And it lasts a long time, the battery. Because I hardly use it. So you use the phone for calling, right? What else do you want to use? The whole life they run, you know? I remember one guy was in the temple, but he was always doing it. I said, what are you doing? I'm working. He was working on his phone. That's amazing nowadays. It is, it's amazing. Anyway, I still have one more chapter, but I think I'll stop here and take questions, I guess. And what I'll do, if you're interested in this book, you can talk to Sarang Thakur Prabhu. It's in the front desk, yeah. So, if you're interested, if you're daring, and but it's a very good book in any case. So, okay, there's only limited copies. Now, actually, we had a box, and then just before we were coming here, someone bought 30 books, and so we are short. 30. Yeah, and we have there's a limited copy. That's a fact. Yeah. So, if you're interested, and it goes for $15, yeah. That's my sales pitch. Oh, Madhuji has a question.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
You said that you don't use your senses to experience, but I was thinking that you'd have to internalize the experience, right? Somehow you have to come across it. If you're not using your senses, then how will it happen?
Yeah, you're not using your mundane senses. The whole idea is you're supposed to purify your senses, right? Rishikesha Rishikena Sevanam Bhakti Uchite, right? Sarva-upadhi-vinirmuktam-tat-paradvina-nirmalam, right? So you, by using your senses in connection with Krishna, nirbandha-krishna-sambandhe-yuktam-vairagavichate. So the whole thing, the whole process is just focused on Krishna. So that way your senses become transcendental or purified. So then when you say, I'm using my senses in Krishna's service, it's totally different from when you come in front of the deities and you look at the deities. The question is, are you seeing the deities? Right? A lot of the time people come in front of the deities and say, oh my Lord, look at me, you know. It's a fact. You know? You're so fortunate I've come today. It's a fact. It's a fact. Yeah, so that's the difference in consciousness than to coming in front of the Lord and say, oh Lord, you know, I'm so happy to see you. And then that's a different consciousness. Then you are using your senses in the right way. Right? One time I remember I was doing aarti, and then it was time to close the curtains after the aarti. And I'm pretty strict about closing the curtains, so I closed the curtains. And just as I closed the curtain, this person outside was shouting, hey, open, open. So I went to the other side, at the side, and then looked out. It was after I closed, I put the deities to rest, and then this person came and started making noise. Then I went and said, yes. Say, I haven't seen the deity. I said, the deities are resting. No, when I was coming in the highway, I had this feeling that the Lord said that I should see him today. I was thinking, did it fall in one of the five categories of religious experience? So I wanted to say, I had a feeling that the Lord said, today you can't see. But I didn't tell her that. I apologized and I said, the Lord is resting, so maybe next time, please come early. So they demand, you know. Yeah. So it's a difference. That's not senses, yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Krishna. My question is, when dealing with other people of other faiths and other beliefs, and who in them may have had actual experiences, some of what you've described here. Are these gods or goddesses that they're experiencing to be looked on as either illusion or as demigods or as aspects of Krishna in some way, like avatars or something else? Is there something, a purport from Prabhupada that addresses how we look at this?
It could be all of the above that you said. At the same time, there is an incident where it depends on your relationship with the person also. If you want to at least discuss the topic or whatever. But there's an incident where one time, I believe the one person was in front of Prabhupada chanting, and then the person said, when I'm chanting, I see a white light. Is it something like that? Blue or white? Oh, so many lights now. Mercy is spreading. So. Anyway, I think to the extent the person was saying they saw a light, let's just leave it at that. So then Prabhupada said, keep chanting and it'll go away. So, you, unless they are close to you and friends, you cannot talk like that. But if they do speak to you and say they have experienced something, yeah, you can encourage them and say you should pray, be careful how you live your life, don't be sinful like that. Bring them, you can guide them towards pious lifestyles if they are not Krishna conscious. It's better to be pious than being sinful. More often than not, you find people will tell you they experience something, but if you dig in deeper, you find they are leading a very sinful life. They may be high on drugs and say, I have visions. Sure. we agree, they have visions.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. I think I should give the... Who, what time is the next speaker's time?
12:05.
Yeah, so she needs time to prepare, right? So, I mean, I'm available later if you want to discuss further. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much for your kind attention. Hare Krishna.